I'm Dick Peterson, and this topic for this morning is Ancient Forests, with the subtitle, I Heard the Owl Call My Faith to Attention. Just to begin with, back in 1987, when I was called by the Division of Missions to go to Liberia, Africa, as a missionary, I had to look at a map and look up to see where Liberia was. And yet I wanted to go real bad, and I knew we could do something important down there. And I always wanted to be a missionary, so we went ahead and said yes, and then did some preparatory reading for it and knew that we would really do the learning once we got there and got involved in the mission there. Well, this year when the Southwest Washington Synod invited my wife and myself to do interim pastoral ministries in the area here, they particularly said that your first interim missionary, or your first interim assignment, would probably be at Forks, Washington.
Oh.
And so I looked at a map to see where, yeah, I looked at a map to see where Forks was, and it's up on the northwest corner of the peninsula. And Steve Morrison from the Synod office said, now one of the real struggles they're having up there is dealing with this spotted owl controversy. So I thought, well, I better start doing a little bit of reading about the spotted owl controversy and see what that's about. So I started reading some magazines, National Geographics and Time and some others, as they had articles on it. And then we sent a wave to the forest industry to get some of their publicity on it. And we sent to the conservation groups to get some of their information on it. And then just kept reading the newspaper and listening to the television comments about the president's task force and their struggle with it. And so what I really tried to do is put together some of that in terms of a summary of what the issue is, and then maybe toward the second part of it we can talk about how we as Christians can be meaningfully involved in the issue and in the kinds of benefits and problems that the issue has been raising for people. And then we can see how we go from there. So I'm sure there are some people that, through being related to the forest industry or working in a logging town or something, will have a lot more information about this. Maybe just within this 1 hour we can do enough to kind of bring everybody up to an equal level of some level of understanding and then go from there. My own history in terms of logging industry is that my dad used to work plywood mill in Eugene, Oregon, and for a number of years. And then when I was going to university, I worked in a plywood mill in Olympia for one summer. We used to live out on an acre of land where we could climb these 150-foot fir trees and get way up at the top. And then we'd see how far we could make them swing to one side or the other. It was a lot of fun. And then as far as clear cutting and stuff, the only thing, the real experience we had of that was we bought a house in Bothell, Washington once, and it backed up onto a big fir-type forest that was part of a mobile park was being developed on the other side. And they give us all kinds of assurances that the woods would stay there, or a certain percentage of the woods, because it was a green belt. We went on vacation once and came back after 3 weeks, and the whole business was flattened, clear up to our fence. Mm-hmm. So it's a different kind. And then, of course, being in Holden and being surrounded by nature here, we also, a few years ago, we bought a piece of property up at Estes Park in Colorado near the Rocky Mountain National Park. And while we were in Liberia, they had to cut out several of the trees because they got pine mistletoe is fairly contagious in those trees. It used to kind of frustrate us because there's a lot of trees there, but there weren't that many, and we were always kind of worried that they were going to take out too many of our trees. So you kind of get involved in issues of forest and logging, and just by being in the Northwest, it's part of our life here. This northern spotted owl has become really a focus for this, I think, this broader issue of what to do with old stands of forest. Spotted owl is I took a little thing out of the National Geographic. It says a spotted owl is only about 2 pounds. It's a white barred brown feathers. And you've probably seen some on some of the 25-cent stamps that you put on your letters to mail out to your friends. But it's a little thing, and it's wondered, you know, the guy raises the issue of how the spotted owl could have become such a central figure for such a great movement of controversy. Just a little background of why the owl has become a focus for deciding how much of this old forest should be preserved from any logging to maintain its natural flow from ancient times. And part of the argument has been that the spotted owl needs this particular kind of environment to continue to exist, and after the spotted owl was put on the endangered species list back in July of this year, then that became even more controversial. But this one forestry research laboratory person named Eric Forsman in Olympia gave these kind of insights about the spotted owl. He says since about 1968 he's been trying to figure out how to observe these spotted owls, and he's learned how to make certain sounds that'll bring a response back from the owls, and he can work his way into the deep woods and find them and kind of do some observing of them. And he said over the years he's noticed that these owls prefer to live in the natural deep woods, and he learned why. He says they nest in tree holes or snags, and then they navigate intermittent foliage to prey on flying squirrels and red-backed voles. The squirrels and the voles feed on various root fungi, including truffles that tap the great trees for sap sugars and help the trees get more nitrogen from the soil. And the trees in turn shelter the flying squirrels and the voles and the owls, completing this interlocking life cycle that gives old forests their special richness and diversity. And then he said it seemed like every time he discovered a new pair of owls, he discovered that they were on a piece of forestry that was going to be up for sale for logging, and he would report this then to his advisors or supervisors. And he says at first they used to say, "Well, what's a spotted owl?" And then afterwards they realized that there was some seriousness to the comment, and they began to make that an issue of whether or not to sell a certain stand of timber based on the presence of these owls there. And they used to ask the question, well, how much acreage of this kind of natural forest do you need to maintain a livable habitat for a pair of owls? And they used to think it was about 300 acres. But then they did some tests. They took little radio transmitters and attached them to some of these owls, and they discovered that instead of using about 300 acres for their foraying for food, they were using about 2,000 acres.
And that's this per pair.
Now, I mean, I don't know if there were other owls within the same 2,000 acres or not, mm-hmm. but they seem to have, over a period of time, decided that the average pair of owls needed 2,000 square acres to roam around in to find enough to eat.
Well, we've got enough owls to cover the whole United States.
Yeah, well. Okay, so this Forest Service biologist, Jack Ward Thomas, headed a kind of a national research study on the owl, and then you know he made this report to President Bush, and that's resulted in this special commission that's been looking through this report, Thomas report, and trying to decide how to legislate something that will on the one hand protect enough habitat for the spotted owl so that the conservationists won't accuse the government of doing something that's in violation of the Endangered Species Act, and at the same time to try to guarantee the continued jobs for loggers and the economies for logging towns and the you know, the income for the logging industry, you know, as much as possible without causing them hardship. And you read different articles in different newspapers and magazines, and the estimates of how many logging jobs would be affected by closing down logging on about, I think they figure maybe like 3 million acres of timber on the West Coast to preserve habitat for these owls. And the estimates always seem to run over a period of 10 years, they say they might be 10 or 20 or 30 or 40,000 jobs lost if the environment is preserved from logging interests. And I assume that means that, you know, there are the loggers themselves, there are the people that the industries involved, there are the small towns that really build their whole economy around the work of the loggers and the presence of the logging sawmills. So there's a and then all the cafes and restaurants and stuff in those towns. I imagine they're assuming all those jobs when they talk about the job loss. They don't mention, and this is probably where a person needs to do more reading background to know whether these jobs, a number of these jobs or towns just may be lost anyway because the timber will run out or modern means of harvesting the trees may cut down on the number of jobs that are available in this kind of automation of the industry. What effect selling the logs to Japan versus finishing the logs in this country? Those are all different factors that could make a difference in the number of jobs that would actually continue to be available, even if the spotted owl thing wasn't there. Now, just this Seattle PI this month was doing a little summary thing in one article, and they mentioned that they asked the question, how many of these spotted owls are there? And they said that there are anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000 pairs of these birds that are thought to be that many. Somewhere between 2,000 to 5,000 pairs. And I guess you can't just multiply that by 2,000, but maybe you could, I don't know. To come out with the number of acres that you need to set aside, but and again, the primary concern is that the environmentalists who have become united in favor of the spotted owl, but really, I think what their broader concern is to preserve for posterity these forests that have never been cut, because there's a certain kind of life cycle systems that are available to those kind of areas that can disappear. Certain other kinds of species, certain kinds of systems of, like the, you know, the owl has certain kinds of animals that it feeds on, and in turn they feed on other things, and that kind of cycle of life there. And I suppose they're also thinking that there are more and more people that just like to be out in the woods, and the experience of a woods that has never been tampered with. In terms of its value for people in the area and for future tourists, I think it's also something that they'll want to consider. Now, kind of along with that information about, you know, our forests and the spotted owl here, that there's a kind of a wider world issue that's also involved, and that's the whole question of how many places in the world are these same kind of problems being dealt with. The problem of forests being logged off or burned down for pasture land and for expansion of housing and these things is not just a problem in the United States, but it's a fairly major problem in South America right now. In the what they call the Amazon Basin in South America, great quantities of tropical forests are being logged, or they're being burned off to provide a grazing land for cattle. They're trying to increase the logging and the cattle production so that they can use it for their export trade for their countries. There's a magazine called World Christian, the April 1990 edition of it, made these comments about this problem in the Amazon basin. It said, the forest is being rapidly degraded here. Great plumes of smoke spread across Brazil as tens of thousands of acres of rainforest are reduced to ashes each week. At present, 47 acres of the world's tropical moist forest are lost per minute, 39,000 square miles per year. Already, Central America has lost 37% of its forests, and South America has lost 36% of its forests. And a recent estimate by Brazil's Institute of Space Research suggests that 20 million acres of Brazil's forest were cleared and burned in 1987 alone. 20 million acres. So, suggesting that if this keeps up at this rate, within a century, we would really have destroyed what should be a source of variety of natural needs for long, long terms to come. He says, now the conversion to this grazing and agricultural land is really for the purpose of a more immediate benefit for export. The country wants to be able to export more logs, export more cattle. And so they've been moving into these rainforest areas, logging, and sometimes just setting fire to the place to burn it down so they could bring in cattle to graze there. And it says part of the problem is that we don't know what the long-term effects are going to be of taking out this large square miles of forestry. Short-term, you can look and you can say, well, it's helping the export trade. We're having more cattle produced, we're producing more logs, and so we're getting more income for that. But what a long-term effect it will have is what they don't know. The Amazon rainforest is a place where a lot of the kind of ecological systems of the world really have some effect. For instance, what they call this greenhouse effect, and I don't know if you've been studying about that, but just basically there's certain gases in the atmosphere that allow the radiation from the sun to come in, and then heat that radiates up off of the Earth's surface is a longer waved radiation, and these gases, certain gases can deflect this radiation then back onto the Earth to keep the temperature of the Earth a certain level. Well, carbon dioxide is one of the gases that is good at reflecting the heat that's radiated off the Earth's surface back down to the Earth. And the more you burn stuff, the more smoke and things that go up into the air with carbon dioxide in them, the more carbon dioxide you have in the air, and the more then of this heat that's reflected off the Earth's surface stays close to the Earth, doesn't go back out into the atmosphere and out away from the Earth. So this is these rainforests, the green in there, you know how the trees, what they call, I don't know if they still call it photosynthesis, but the idea that the sun's rays and the carbon dioxide hit these tree leaves, the green of the trees, it goes through a transformation inside the green and comes out as oxygen. But if the trees are not there, then this carbon dioxide is not changed into oxygen that way, so it stays in the atmosphere. Anyway, there are a series of ways in which the amount of carbon dioxide has been increasing in the atmosphere. Like I think since 1860, the amount of carbon dioxide in the air is supposed to have increased by 26%. So there's just that much more of a kind of a blanket up there that keeps once the sun's rays have heated up the Earth, then when the heat goes back up into the atmosphere, it stops and stays close to the Earth. So they talk about this potential for a warming, an increased warming of the Earth's surface. and then they try to envision what that can have, what effects that can have on the earth. It could cut down, like when I was in Liberia, one of the things we noticed is that you can go for 120 miles along the one road that's paved up through the middle of Liberia, and you never see anything that resembles a natural forest. They've replaced everything with either rubber plantations or places where people, about every 5 to 7 years, they burn off a section, and then they plant rice there, and then it grows up for, you know, kind of regrows up for 4 or 5 years, and then they cut it down and burn it again. So that's all you see in large areas of Liberia, and the logging companies have been going in there for a number of years now, taking out these great big, what they call high cover jungle. They used to cover all most of Liberia, and at one point they realized they were taking out many logs, and so they said, well, they talked to the government about this, and they said, you know, if you want us to, we really should be replacing these trees. So what we'll do is as we cut the trees out, we can replace them with new seedlings, you know. They said, the other way we can do it, if you want to, we can just give you a certain amount of money and you can do it, you know, in any ways that you want to. And the government of Liberia said, well, hey, why don't you give us some money and we'll do it. So they gave them the money, but Liberian government never does anything like that. So they just, the money just disappeared and the trees never got replanted. And when we first came there in 87, people were saying that because of the deforestation going on there and for whatever reason, the Sahara is kind of spreading southward, that within possibly 15 or 20 years, what we were living in as a rainforest could well become, you know, substantially desert just because of the changes in the cycle of the air and the water and so on. And so people are afraid the same thing can happen in Brazil, where there's just a whole lot more of this rainforest. If it's all leveled out and so that the cycles of nature, the rain cycle and the carbon dioxide to oxygen cycle can't take place. They said that maybe the place we'll really feel it is, you know, when I ended up in Colorado, if you look at the national weather maps on the TV, they'd show this moisture always coming up from the Gulf of Mexico. And assume that a good portion of that then comes from the Brazil rainforest up across the Gulf and up into the United States, and it comes into the Midwest there. Well, if the rain stops being produced in the Amazon Basin, there's going to be less of that moisture coming up through the Gulf of Mexico and up into the United States, which could mean that there could be a, you know, more extensive drought area in what we call the Midwest, which is where a lot of our, you know, corn and wheat products are produced. It could then all of a sudden there could be no water there for people, so we could have a desert in the middle of the United States. So we just never know what the long-term effects of this deforestation are going to be. So on one hand, for us over in the Pacific Northwest, the problem is whether or not the spotted owl is going to continue to be able to survive in certain areas of the forest. But around the world, the broader picture is whether or not this deforesting of large areas is going to make some changes in the weather, the changes in the temperature of the Earth's surface. There was a magazine that I was reading here in the library. It was talking about the problem of the poor people in Brazil. They've had worse government systems down there even maybe than they've had in Liberia as far as the government caring about what happens to the people is concerned. But there was a 1985 report in the government in Brazil that said that 2% of the landowners in Brazil hold 60% of the land that can, you know, produce something. And 70% of the rural households of people have little or no land. And then it said that 342 farm properties in Brazil cover 183,397 square miles, bigger than the state of California. So 342 landowners in Brazil own more property together than the whole state of California is one big piece. And see, so many people, so it's just very inequitable distribution of land there in Brazil. And he goes on to say that the same problem contributes to the problem of the forests in Brazil. Because these landowners are keeping this property for speculation. Now, they only produce crops on a portion of it, or graze cattle on a portion of it. They just buy it and hold on to it until the price goes up, and then they sell it, speculating that way. He says what this has done is pushed the population up into these rainforests of Brazil there, and most of the people that actually do get a lot of land in the rainforest is the same rich people that own all the other land. So they go up there and they raise all their cattle up in the rainforest. And it says this soil in the rainforest area is so fragile that after a few years of grazing and stuff, it all just turns into a bunch of bush. So then they just move further into the rainforest to just produce, you know, more cattle and things, and they're just the whole place is just kind of falling apart. But it's these same rich people that are keeping the land from the poor who are also making more and more money on the rainforest. So it's just, I think it's a way of showing how when we talk about working with justice issues in the world, we're trying to see if the poor people of the world can have a better chance at life. The poor people end up being the victims of this kind of deforestation as well, because they're the ones that they go into the forest and they're making it pretty good up there. One of these rich people comes along, and there's all sorts of titles to each piece of property in Brazil, and if it goes to court, a rich person against a peasant, the rich person is always going to win the case and get the property. So if a poor person finally decides they're going to be able to make something pretty nice and they develop a piece of land and claim title to it, some rich person might come along and claim title to it as well. They take it to court and the rich person wins. So it's a struggle of the rich against the poor, as well as logging against the non-loggers and things. Okay, well, then any questions on that before we kind of turn to another part of it?
I've got questions, but it's not regarding what.
Okay. Well,
so
what?
I don't know if you want me to wait till.
Well, basically, okay, I can just say what we thought we'd kind of do for the rest of the time is try to see, you know, how we as Christians, I suppose we have to really deal first with the issue right in our area here.
Well, that's what I was going to
ask
you.
What kind of particular things could we as Christians be involved in? What kind of way do we have looking at this thing that might be helpful for us? So,
well, you're right in the middle of this, Father Dowell, mm-hmm. Preaching to those loggers and so forth. So I just wanted to know what your feeling was living among the people.
Okay, one thing is, I didn't end up going to Forks.
Oh, you didn't.
Before, well, in the process, it just worked out that they ended up assigning us to different interim positions. But when we were trying to imagine what we'd do there, there's just, when it becomes a very personal issue like it is among the people here, where if three of your families were involved in logging, and maybe one family, the parent or the person was working with a conservation group, and somebody else had a cafe in a small logging town. I mean, and so and you get an issue like this, and it's not kind of a just an issue that's out there that everybody's kind of looking at objectively. It's
well,
your job and stuff.
The thing I was thinking about that particular area is in 1982, and I don't know how many square miles, but Olympic National Park was made a World Wilderness Park. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's not logging in the park, it's in the national forest, isn't it, that it happens. I don't think they're allowed to log in the park area. And I just wondered how many square miles there was in park and how many square miles there were in forest. Because it being a wilderness park, there's a place for the spotted owl protected right there. And of course, we also have the two rainforests there, mm-hmm. the Ho and the Pinault rainforest.
Now, I know that they're logging quite a bit pretty close to the hole there, because you can see it from the road, and it's very ugly.
Those very specific particulars about, you know, where the acreages are and things, you don't really, you know, the newspaper articles, of course, they're more general than that, so they don't usually give you that kind of detail. That one National Geographic, I was hoping it was here, it's a September issue, September 1990 issue, is a really good article on the owl thing in the ancient forest. If you get a copy of it, it comes through here, it might be a good one to use. It was talking about, and again, now whether it was talking about the Olympic Forest or the Olympic National Park, I imagine they probably don't actually do the forest, the logging in the park, but anyway, they were talking about that there's only 10 to 14% of the forest that's actually left, that's never been logged, and that this has happened over just a fairly recent number of years. That used to be, you know, like 75%. Now there's only 10 to 15% of it that hasn't been logged. And there's some little maps in there that show little square blocks of what's still left, and it kind of looks like, you know, somebody's taken the greater.
You'll be in the national forest, and then you'll be in the national park, just mile by mile, all the way down.
Yeah, and that's, I see, when you get close enough to a specific area, you can be much more.
I retired from Olympic National Park.
Okay. That's I know the closest we had was in Colorado, one of the suburb cities, I think it was was Westminster, up the northern part of Denver. My wife had a church up in Ault, which was just a road coming up from Denver, and it's the suburbs down here, and then Greeley was here, and Ault was about 15 miles north. And there was a time when the value of property was way down, the farm economy was way down about 7 or 8 years ago. And a real estate guy came in and just started buying all sorts of farms around here. And we couldn't figure out, you know, what he was up to. I mean, he's offering great prices, and the farmers were really going broke, so those that were really going, you know, really down, they sold because the price wasn't bad, and they just were going broke otherwise. But there were some that you know, said, no, we've got to stay in here and hold on. So they didn't sell. Well, what they found out afterwards is that this realtor was up there buying land on behalf of this subdivision development down in here in Denver. And what he was really wanting to do was buy the farms, get the water rights, resell the farms as dry land farms. They were going to take this water and run it through pipes back down here to the suburb. And what this would mean, you know, they could put up more houses, and it would be nice for the suburb development here. But basically, it was going to change the structure of the whole region around this little town. Basically, the town would eventually dry up, because you can't, the dry land farming is really too precarious to do there in Colorado, compared to like the irrigating farming that they're able to do now. So this was in her congregation. There were people that were selling, and there were people that were holding. And, you know, and they said, so one of the problems that the people that held on, they know that as soon as you take enough water out of the system, the irrigating canals are not going to run enough water to get it over the little dams that they use to gauge how much water each farmer is going to get. And if the people down, you know, down toward the beginning of the canal have sold out, that water is being diverted. The water may never get high enough for you to get any water back there, even though you still have water rights for it. So it was really a controversial kind of thing. And I'm sure that in the congregation, all people had been friends for farming next to each other, for their families have been friends for years and years. And I just guess it's probably the same thing in the logging communities. People have been logging, and their father logged there, and maybe their grandfather, and all of a sudden somebody's going to come along and close down opportunities for logging there, and it's they could care less whether the spotted owl makes it or not, because their whole family's livelihood and the a community that's been there all that time, their church. Maybe there's a graveyard there where all their ancestors have been buried, and you know, the thing's going to just disappear, and what to do. So it takes a, on the one hand, that the Christian church wants to be seeing itself in a stewardship role relative to the environment, saying that God has created all these things in a beautiful way. There are systems that interact with each other, to like the spotted owl needs a certain kind of habitat because there are all kinds of systems that together make life, support systems for each other. We believe that when God makes human beings into stewards or administrators, he says, have dominion over the world. The wise manager is the person who can look at all the different parts of whatever they're managing and see how they best work together in most harmonious relationships, and then take the authority to see that that's the way that things work. That's what a good manager does. And so if we discover how the ecological systems in the forests work best and protect all the different parts of the species that are involved there, then our responsibility as good stewards under God is to accept the responsibility to see that you know, that there's a continuation of that. I think most of the systems do real well until people get there. So it's really a matter of just making sure we don't mess them up too bad.
Greed seems to be the big thing that stands in our way.
Yeah. Part of the problem with the conservation concern for logging is that it gets carried away. Like, they might have a small family logging operation that's been going on in a town for years and years, and they've been carefully cutting a little here and a little there and making sure that it was reestablished and not overcutting and just cutting enough. But then maybe the parent company gets sold out to somebody else, and this person says, you know, the book's not looking good today, we've got to cut, you know, 1.45 as much lumber next year as we did this year to look good to our stockholders. So regardless of how this family company wants to do it, they're still to either cut more timber or we'll replace you with somebody else. And so or they buy them out and then they bring in their own workers and say, okay, you know, cut as much timber as you can, because we got a new market now, we can sell more, don't worry about, you know, this and that. So it gets to be out of the hands of the local people to regulate what was being done well before. But as far as the community is concerned, you know, either the operation continues or it shuts down. And I think Christian sensitivity to, you know, just make blanket statements about, you know, the logging is too much, or, I mean, because then people say, hey, we've been doing it really well all these years. And it's you know, as far as a congregation, then to try to be very much, you know, have a strong point of view, but at the same time, try to have a sensitivity to what people are going through.
We're commanded to feed the hungry, too.
Yeah. And it doesn't just have to be people over in Africa. I mean,
no.
If there are,
well, another way to look at it too is that humans, you know, we don't look at things from here are human beings and here's the rest of the natural world. I mean, we've been a part of the natural world for centuries, and to, you know, separate that out, I mean, it's either people or, mm-hmm. I mean, we've been interacting for centuries, and are part of the system. We're not separate from it.
Trying to find some way to see, it's when this greed business gets in a larger, you know, institution is in charge of harvesting, and maybe somebody has their base of operation in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and they have logging mills up and down the West Coast, and their stockholders say, you know, we need more production, or we're going to get a new president. So the president says to the little logging companies, you guys produce more, or we're going to close you down. I mean, so even if.
Worked on the farms back in the Middle West too.
Yeah, right. It's the farmers have had the other side of it, yeah. About the time you get a good year on with the wheat, then the price of wheat goes way down. or you have a drought or a rain at the end of it. So I don't know, it's just any other, have you any of you worked, you know, been with people now that are right in the middle of this struggle, either friends or relatives or family or anybody that's
not relatives, but friends.
What kind of things are they saying or doing?
Well, see, I always think about this greed situation. And I don't know how the priest logging has handled it. But they've sold part of theirs off too. But I just hear how poor it is, you know. And I think part of that's greed because they got plenty to live on. So on one hand I'm critical, and then when I see people come into Holy Trinity for food that have never thought of that happening to them, and they're almost ashamed to do it. They are ashamed to do it, to come in and ask for food. You just, the pastors really have to work with them and talk to them about that. Then you see the other side of it, you know. But these aren't the owners of the logging, these are the workers.
Certainly the kind of people that belong to the environmental groups, particularly outfits like the Sierra Club and the Audubon Society, tend to be wealthy, upper middle class folks from eastern states where they're far removed from what goes on. And they pour the money into those organizations and then they do the legal work to make things happen. And
yeah, so they're on the other hand, it's almost as
they take
uninformed about the little right. Logging towns as the big chain firms back east that have their companies out here. And where the churches are in these small towns, they're right in it, and it's a good chance to bring in a real sensitivity. Part of our Christian faith says that we're to love each other. I think the more you love a person, the more you're sensitive to what things are going on with them, and try to help them struggle through and discover some way to resolve either conflicts or to set a new direction for their life or something. I don't know if the other problem with the churches probably in some of those small logging towns is that they're pretty much strapped for they're kind of just barely making it themselves. So they see two or three logging families move out, and all of a sudden their whole structure and they start thinking about self-survival too.
Right.
And so they forget about this, the broader problem.
Well, I think Forks is still a mission church, isn't it?
Yeah, I got the impression it's really gone down in terms of number of people that are there. I don't know whether, like I said, we didn't get there to know whether it was caused by the controversy or just people leaving or poor evangelism.
A lot of people have left.
Yeah.
And then they built a prison out there. That's hired some people, but loggers are just like family farms.
It's an independent group, yeah.
Yeah.
They're learning to be strongly independent out there cutting trees and stuff.
Very dangerous work.
Mm-hmm. They get high pay when things are going well, and they can just lose it all together like the farmers. I mean, well, the farmers really don't ever get that well to do, I don't think, anymore. But if they're on a wage, like the least loggers can sometimes be on a wage rather than, cost sharing or something.
And some of the mills have been taken over, are sold to Japan firms, Japanese firms.
Yeah, I think one of the as far as the logging industry is concerned, that's been good because they pay better, I guess, than local pay. They get better price for the logs when they sell them to Japan for some reason, because I guess they want them so bad. So they want to sell them,
well,
and then
that, that cut down on the logging in that area when they because it was cut down, only so much could go to Japan. So a lot of the logging was cut down right then because that's where they were getting the big prices.
Well, that was a recent action to cut down on the percentage that they could send to Japan.
Well, I think.
Or has that been a kind of a standard?
It's been at least 10 years ago.
Okay. I think it was, wasn't there something more recently that to certain areas not to send any logs to Japan?
I think that's
and that's been
a new
development.
They were just processed and sent back here.
Yeah.
Because then, of the cheaper labor. But now one of the pilot mills, I think, is owned by a Japanese firm.
Mm-hmm. I think there's one up in Alaska. Somebody was talking earlier this week. I think one of the big companies up in Alaska is owned by Japanese. So they're sending all their logs home for production. And I'm sure that has some negative effects on. I mean, it gives good income to the certain logging industry, but it also has its negative effect on jobs.
Yeah.
Because of the,
and Canada too affects it. They have different laws there.
And how much is allowed to be imported and how much is exported, and it's a very broad area, and you know, Christian response could be to say, well, this is too complicated an issue, we should just stay out of it. Pray together and sing together and hope it all works out, all right?
Well, and see, the other thing that it affects a lot in that area is shipping. There are ships in there all the time loading logs.
From where is this now?
In the Port Angeles.
Oh, Port Angeles, yeah.
Area. And
That gives jobs too. If there's
a
thriving shipping industry, that's jobs, different forms.
Because we had a lot of longshoremen up there. Well, they're union, they can't do anything else. So they have to move to get work.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any programs of retraining for loggers to do, to move into other areas of work?
I'm not aware of that. Yeah. I'm not that close to it.
Mm, sure.
That would have to be the answer in part to have the federal programs that have the retraining and.
Mm-hmm, I think so. Yeah.
When Alcoa Aluminum shut down in Vancouver, they had federal programs to take care of people that had to switch careers, where their expenses were paid in their school and to attend community college and or trade school and. To shift gears.
Yeah. Like I said, the church has not set a great precedent for that in its own practice. When we have a national merger, there's just a whole lot of people get laid off with no prep or anything. And so we go into places like Pennsylvania and protest that the steel companies are not making provision for shifting people to different job sites and things. So sometimes our own witness within our own system is not too strong, but still the idea that to try to encourage these larger corporations to make that kind of adjustment for their workers is just it's a real important part of our responsibility. Well, any other, maybe other questions? I think, in terms of what the church, make sure that there's a good communication going on within the congregation and try to be sensitive to really hurting spots in the congregation and making sure that this Christian experience and expression of love reaches out and touches with some comfort and encouragement the people that are being most in the midst of the struggle. Some kind of more objective dialogues where the issues are given opportunity to be discussed, because even a logger could really not be aware of the broader implications of what's happening, and it would be probably valuable for them to also know about the, you know, the overall problem of forests throughout the world and things, just to broaden their perspective in the whole issue. We've always talked about praying together as a kind of a resource for Christians, talking about the opportunity of being stewards of all that we have, set for these responsibilities under God. It's still a new area. Every time the Christian church is presented with one of these new social crises, it's just you got to sit back, briefly look at it, and then try to decide how to be involved in it. And sometimes it just hits you, like these churches in some of these areas. All of a sudden, you know, one day there can be an announcement that a certain percentage of logging is going to be cut down, and a whole town might close up, and you don't really have a time to make an adjustment to it.
Well, sometimes the issue, as you say, is so critical that they're not even ready to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, they're just filled with anger. And it's just like in our churches in the San Francisco area that went ahead and hired pastors against the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of churches that will not, don't even want to hear about it. They don't even want to study or hear, listen.
Yeah.
And I think that's true on a lot of, I mean, 20 years ago it was women pastors in the church, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of people that didn't even want to talk about it. It just shouldn't be. And so you have to lay groundwork, as you say, and to get to the point of being able to educate them.
Yeah. The other, when you mentioned this anger thing, I think that's one of the other things that happens is that the church, to, you know, there can be a increase in like alcoholism and family breakup just because of the anger and rage that they take back from the workplace and the frustration and things. So the church needs to be sensitive to that particular aspect of it, make sure that people have some outlets of, you know, counseling and just, you know, coping with change in the family setting or those kind of what we might call social involvements too. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming today. And
thank you.